Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
I could talk about that for a while if you want to get me started.
The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from? The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast where we bring you conversations with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotaro. This was episode number 5, a summer 2012 talk with one of my favorite MCs, Invincible. Since starting their career in the Detroit battle scene as a teenager, Invincible has been one of hip-hop's most notable talents. They have consistently taken the path of artistic freedom, rejecting record deal after record deal from labels who wanted to turn the white Detroit-based rapper into another Eminem. Instead, they have stayed true to themselves and released smart, engaged music that draws on their experiences both as a veteran MC and as a political organizer for Detroit Summer. Their full-length album is called Shapeshifters, and their new project, Complex Movements, will illuminate the connections between complex science, social movements, and hip-hop. A note about the language in this episode. At the time this interview was recorded, Invincible was using female pronouns, but has now switched to the gender-neutral pronoun they. I spoke to Invincible outside of Joe's Pub in New York City hours before a concert. I began by asking the rapper, who spent much of their early childhood living with their Jewish family in Israel, but since has become an outspoken supporter of Palestinian causes, about their opinions on Israel and Palestine. If you like The Cypher and want to see it continue, visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and consider making a donation. We even have special rewards and experiences for our donors. And also, visit The Cypher on iTunes. From there, you can rate, review, and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Giving us a 5-star rating or reviewing the show is one of the best things you can do to make sure that The Cypher reaches a wider audience. And now, from the steps of the Public Theater in Manhattan, here's Invincible.
Welcome back to New York.
Thank you. Yeah. Always good to be here.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you first off about the evolution of your thinking on the whole Israel-Palestine issue.
Okay, let's just jump right in.
Yeah, jump right in, right? And there's a particular reason I ask it. It's because many of the, like, people that I've met personally who are, like, the most pro-Zionist are people who, like you, lived in Israel when they were young, but spent most of their adult lives in the United States. And I was just wondering how someone with those same experiences came to, you know, such
a different
point of view. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, where do I start? I guess for me, when I moved back to the U.S., I was born in the U.S.,
right.
moved to occupied Palestine when I was 1, moved back to the U.S. when I was 7. And when I moved back, I was in Michigan, and first in Ann Arbor, and then now I'm in Detroit.
Yeah.
And Southeast Michigan has the largest Arab community in the country.
Right.
And so many of my childhood friends were from the Middle East, and it would just be natural for us to discuss what was happening back home,
right.
You know, where our families were from. So we would have a lot of just deep conversations about it. And, you know, there was direct ways that my friends were being impacted and their families were being impacted.
Yeah.
So, for example, I remember when I was, like, in middle school, I met this friend of mine through the basketball team, and her older brother was our coach, and their uncle, who was back home in Palestine, he had been imprisoned by the Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, and tortured in prison, all for, like, you know, nonviolent resistance, like organizing a rally or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just remember being, like, completely blown away when I heard that story, because it was so different from the story I had been told,
right.
about what the Israeli military did, you know, and
yeah.
and I never really heard before that another perspective on it, because the only story that I was told growing up was like how great they were, how brave they were, how honorable. I remember when I was in first grade, which was my last grade living in Israel-occupied Palestine, like they brought Israeli soldiers into our school. There was a day of the year where they brought the Israeli soldiers in and we had to like give them a gift. And it was like, you know what I'm saying, like Secret Santa, but yeah, with an Israeli soldier. Yeah. And you just knew like you were going to become them when you got older, because you're all required to serve. You get jailed if you don't.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it was like for me, like putting it together when I was hearing this story from my friend in middle school and her telling me about the torture that her uncle had to go through, and me thinking like that could have been the soldier I gave that present to. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, it's like connecting the dots between the real personal stories that my friends were telling me and that their families were experiencing, and then kind of, you know, unlearning all the stories I had been taught, you know, from the perspective of the occupier, you know.
Did it change the memories of your childhood at all, learning all this stuff?
1,000%, you know what I'm saying? It just, to me, like, it just illuminated so much of what I had been told from a totally different frame. You know, like instead of thinking about, you know, instead of thinking about the drills, we used to have to do drills in school. Like the way, okay, when I got to Michigan, we would have to do, you know, fire drills, tornado drills.
Right.
Like when I was a kid in Iraq by Palestine, you'd have to do like bomb drills. Like me and my friends used to like go and we would like, for fun, because we had nothing else to do.
Yeah.
We would go and take like cardboard and slide down this this concrete structure, and we would just slide down on the cardboard like you know, snowboarding or whatever, and you know, scrape ourselves all up every time. Yeah. And I realized looking back, I was like, that was a bomb shelter. Like sliding down the bomb shelter with cardboard for fun. Yeah. And I remember looking back at it, and like particularly during the Gulf War, because my best friend that I actually started rapping with when we were nine, like her family was from Iraq. And during the Gulf War, you know, we were in elementary school. She used to call her grandmother every day in Baghdad to see if she had survived that day's bombing.
And
I remember, you know, like there was a couple instances where there was like a bomb threat in Tel Aviv where my aunt was living at the time. And I remember like one time that, you know, my mom had called her sister and was like, are you okay? She was like, okay, why? Like, she had slept through it. You know what I mean? It wasn't even like, it wasn't even something she really noticed.
Yeah.
And it was like so disproportionate. And it was like seeing, you know, my best friend, next door neighbor's family, like experiencing loss and great, you know, devastation to their whole community, their family, their country. And like having this real visceral fear around it. And then this like completely like, you know, oblivious like privilege that my family in Tel Aviv was able to have. And then to like think about that in context of like the fear mongering that we were given through those, you know, bomb drills, and, you know, having the bomb shelter right there as like a playground site. You know what I mean? Like the fact that those were really just around like implanting fear in our brain and like making fear like the mentality that was able to somehow rationalize or justify like the violence and occupation and like human rights abuses that are being committed in our name and by our people all the time, every day, by on Palestinians and Palestinian land. So
okay,
I could talk about that for a while if you want to get me started. But we can go to the next.
Right, that kind of ties into something that I wanted to ask, which is like in your songs, you have a lot of really nuanced political ideas about wars. No pretending we codependent. You're killing in my name. I get to blame your codependent. So much arrogance is an embarrassment. See a therapist for your paranoia of terrorism. While terrorizing, analyzing flaws in your character. Do you really love me or just lust for power? America. Oh, beautiful with your spacious skies. I want to love you. About like the function of cops. Point your observations of the chief of police. Point about a mayor who betrays you like Cons and Donald Goinsley. Backdoor deals, cause the chief is on the board of the new prison and they grease his palms slicker than some ointment. You know, you have about U.S. foreign policy. Couldn't stand a chance, even bombed Susan's hospitals, Maas Rafa and Khan Yunus. Shot them in their back like the cop to Oscar Grant. And in each case, the good old United States sponsored that. $7 million a day that we pay tax and Apex lobbyists is robbing us. Sometimes it feels like there ain't no stopping this. But how do you fit that into a song? Like, how do you make those ideas rhyme and not make it seem like, okay, listener, I'm going to teach you something? How do you avoid being
so didactic? Yeah. I put so much work into my lyrics, and I know so many other lyricists to do, and 9 times out of 10, you feel like people don't really, you know, take the time to break it down and listen. Yeah. And for me, like, growing up, you know, I've said this 1,000 times, but it's like, lyrics is how I learned English, you know, sitting there listening to hip-hop and writing down the words and looking up what they meant and trying to dissect it. Like, and I know so many people that still do that. And and I really appreciate that y'all take the time to actually, you know, pay attention to the nuances. So thank you for that. But to answer your question, like, man, the last thing I want to do is to be like, you know, just giving a speech or an essay or a lecture. You know what I mean? Like, for me, it's all about the... To me, it's about, like, a couple things. One is, you know, I do a lot of research when I write, you know, whether it be through conversations, through interviews, through, you know, just sitting there and just, you know, looking it up and reading about it. But ultimately, like, I don't just sit there and take an idea verbatim. Like, it usually takes me a long time to write songs because I'll take an idea and I'll research it, but then I'll just, like, live with it, you know what I'm saying, and let it kind of, like, kind of synthesize and apply to my life in real ways. And then it becomes less sort of like just an idea or a theory. It becomes a story that's related to my life.
Right.
You know, so not so as much as often as possible, like when I'm talking about complex ideas that I might have done a lot of research around, like I try to tell them through a story.
Right.
And I think narrative is like the number one way where it's no longer, you know, just beating you over the head with a concept or with your didactic idea about something. And then secondly, you know what I'm saying, just really paying attention to the craft. Like, you know, when I write a song, like the first thing I think about is not the concept, is not, you know, really anything except for the cadence and the flow. Like that's, I come at it like when my voice is an instrument. And that way it's like, even if it's not necessarily a story or like a complex multi-layered analogy or metaphor, you know, which I do like to do as often as possible, like it's still like musical,
right?
You know what I mean? And it's about the music first. It's about the wordplay. I like putting words together. I like putting stuff together like a jigsaw puzzle. Like every rhyme to me, I used to think about it like an eclipse. Like if you were to see like the shape of a word and then see like another word that, you know, is eclipsed by that fits around the same shape. You know what I mean? It's like real visual to me how I write. So to find words that have like similar sounds and you know can roll off your tongue in a certain way. That's the first thing I approach lyrics through.
Yeah.
And then the ideas I kind of have to like fit them within that. And I always say like to slip the medicine in. Like you know, I put all those things in place first as the foundation, and then the ideas can kind of like, you know, be launched off of those. Those serve as the foundation for it.
Excellent. That reminds me of, I heard this one like Beanie Siegel outtake, and he's doing the song, and then at the third verse he just run out of words, but he keeps going for a while, just throwing in syllables and stuff like that as kind of a place filler.
I'm well seasoned, well groomed. God damn, I'm in bloom. Next season is boom. Four engines go, the four engines will blow. Or
almost like scatting and jazz.
Yeah,
like
exactly,
that. Yeah.
Exactly. And I assume those would later be reworked into lyrics or whatever.
Yeah.
When you talk about work, you have that one line about, you know, ain't no way to rush the process.
Yeah.
Right, and that kind of ties into what you were saying. It takes you a while to write songs and stuff like that.
My excuse for being the slowest rapper on earth.
Right. Uh-huh. What's your thought about this whole, like, post-Lil Wayne thing of releasing just a glut of work in order to make a name for yourself?
Man, you know what? Like, I think that's the greatest thing ever, and I admire it greatly. Like, for how slow I am, and everybody's always like, man, that's what makes your work so intricate and meticulous. Man, fuck that. Like, I wish I could just let it go and just be like not such a perfectionist every time and just write some and put it out in the world. Like I greatly admire that. You know what I'm saying? It's a certain freedom to that approach that is beautiful. Now on the other side of that, you know, I think, you know, someone like Wayne, and you know, I don't listen to Wayne often enough to really know, you know,
sure,
what I'm saying, how intricate his lyrics are or not. But, you know, I think like I think once you get into a craft long enough, you know, you have the freedom to be a little more like whimsical with it, a little less, you know, like a little less meticulous depending on what your approach is, you know what I mean? So maybe that comes with time. And I think where that goes hugely wrong is when like rappers who are newer to writing take that approach.
And every thought in their head comes out of the record.
Yeah, it's like, you know what I'm saying? To me, like, to get to that point where you can just, like, create something, put it out, like, that's after a long period of, like, deep regimen, discipline, practice, where then you can be like, okay, like, anything that come out is built off that practice. Like, I've created that muscle memory where I know how to write a song and turn it around, you know what I mean? So that's where, to me, the problem lays, you know what I mean, is when people don't put that initial practice in.
Nice. I wanted to go back in time for a second, if I could. When I was doing research for this, I came across a review of this tour in 2000 of you you opening for La Tigra. And I was surprised to see that. What was that like? How did the punk rock fans, the Riot Girl fans, react to you back then?
The tour I was on with La Tigra wasn't just me. It was Anomalies. Mm-hmm. But, like, a week before the tour, all the other Anomalies decided that they couldn't make it for various reasons, like life shit, you know?
Right.
So basically, it ended up just being me and La Tigra on the majority of the tour. Big Tara from Anomalies, who will be performing with me later, she did a couple of the dates.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, that was such a hugely life-changing experience for me, like to be able to spend that time with them. And I didn't know barely anything at that point about the Riot Girl movement and about, you know, like, what... They were beyond Riot Girl at that point. They were like post Riot Girl and like transforming, like, and critiquing the different problematic elements of Riot Girl. You know what I mean? So it was like amazing to be a part of that moment in history. And also, like, for me at that point in my career, I was being approached by a lot of record labels and I was turning down deals. And I knew what I didn't want, but I didn't really have a lot of working models of independent women artists. And like being around La Tigra, like, I got to see them like organizing their own tour, like doing, you know, a lot of the work themselves and putting out this record with, you know, this independent label that was run by women. And it was just like one of the greatest models for me to learn from. And as far as the crowds, I mean, it varies city to city, you know what I'm saying? Some cities would just sit there like with their jaws on the floor because they had never like seen hip hop before, and they had all these like just like complete misconceptions of it, you know. We went to some like pretty small towns. Like my last night on one of the legs was like Lawrence, Kansas. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But then, you know, other cities were you know open to it. They loved it, and they to them it was like it was just a perfect fit to have Anomalies and La Tigra on one stage, and it was just an honor to be part of that.
Nice. That's fantastic. You mentioned, obviously, like, the time in which you're being offered a lot of deals and stuff.
Yeah.
During that period, you were battling a lot, right?
Yeah.
On Long Awaited, you say about how you've stopped battling.
No, that'll have to go. I don't battle no more. Make an album so dope you stand it up to speak without a paddle boat. I don't write rhymes. I write ransom notes.
Now, when I talked to Solkhan about this, you know, about battling, obviously he was in the battle scene later, but he was saying he had a lot of regrets about battling, about a lot of the language that he used. He felt it encouraged homophobia, encouraged sexism, and that he felt the performers didn't take it seriously, but the fans did, and he still feels really bad about it. It's part of the reason why he stopped.
That's the thing. It's not like in battle rap people are ever like quick to say, oh, I made a homophobic remark, but don't worry. It was just in the context of a battle. I don't think that there's any problem with homosexuality. No one ever does that. Maybe they should, but I don't know if it'd be taken as seriously. But, you know, it's, and then there's this whole attitude like, come on, don't take it seriously, it's just a battle. That's a very new thing.
Why, what's your history on the Detroit battle scene? Why did you stop?
For me, battling to me is like a big part of a phase in an MC's life that you kind of have to go through, like, It's an element of paying your dues in a way. And particularly in that era, like particularly in the mid-90s, it was all about battling in Detroit. And not as much out here in New York at that time.
Yeah.
And how I got the name Invincible was because like everybody battled and you just had to come with a name that was like a battle-worthy name.
Right.
And so also that look good when you tag it or whatever, you know, I mean, that's where it all comes from, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, anytime you would start a cypher and you would freestyle, somebody would cut you off and start battling you, and you would just have to be ready to go. Yeah. It wasn't even like organized like that. It would just pop off like on any corner after any show and you know, any club or whatever. And for me, like, I was 15 years old when I first started, like, steadily, you know, going to open mics and shows and things like that. And so I had a lot of people, you know, trying to basically, you know, just overlook me or disrespect me. And so I had to battle in a way to earn my respect. But after a while, I felt like it was completely limiting what my possibilities were as an artist. And, you know, to me, it was like a phase that I had to go through to prove myself. But at a certain point, it became like a fortress that locked me in from being able to expand, like, what I was rhyming about, what I was talking about. And then when I came to New York for the first time, I was 16, and I remember being in a cypher and nobody tried to battle anybody. Like, everybody just, like, built off the last thing somebody said. And it was with Wordsworth, my first time in New York. I was in a cypher with, like, Wordsworth and Wise Guy and a couple other dope artists. And Destroy was there from Arsonist, who actually later introduced me to the Anomalies.
Right.
And I remember, like, Wordsworth started telling a story, and everybody started finishing the story, and we were all just, like, you know, getting so creative with it. And I just felt like battling was the opposite of that. It instead of getting people to be more creative, 9 times out of 10, it just, you know, it just made people more fearful to be creative because they might get, you know, this or might lose the battle at that point, you know. So I just felt like it was real limiting to creativity. And then, yeah, I think it brings out the worst in people, in the sense that, you know, it's hilarious to see, like, people battling and clowning each other to a certain extent. But when you start seeing people, you know, stoop to pretty low levels, and I saw it firsthand being part of the battle scene, you know, and I sometimes stoop to that low level myself, you know what I mean? And
sure.
And I feel like ultimately, like, it's a total waste of my creative energy,
okay.
You know? And for how much time and intentionality I put into my lyrics, like, it just felt like a waste of what I'm capable of doing.
Excellent. So one of the big figures on the battle scene at that time, of course, was Proof. Mm-hmm. You wrote In the Morning about Proof and Dilla.
Yeah.
No time to mourn him, late, no excuse. Brought us together, blessed us with beats. Rhymes live forever, flesh obsolete. Mourn this poem to the cornerstone. Two pillars, proof dealers, so support your own.
And I think their ghosts or their spirits are kind of all over the record.
Yeah.
In some ways, you steal his voice.
Hold tight, you don't pay attention, man. That's why your money is the size of your attention span. Yo, yo, yo.
Yeah.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your power is the size of your attention span. Dilla said it best.
You don't pay attention, man.
That's why your respect's the size of your attention span. It's precious.
And I think in other ways, they kind of show through.
Yeah.
What was your relationship with the two of them, either personally or if you don't want to talk about that with their music?
Man, Proof was like a big brother to me and so many other people on the scene. Like, he was always very supportive. Like, every time I saw him, he would just, like, come up to me and quote a lyric I said at an open mic the last time I saw him. He was just very attentive to, like, every up-and-coming artist on the scene and just really took us under his wing as much as he could.
Yeah.
One time I was in this battle in Philly, and he was out there because his D12 group mate, or Dirty Dozen at that time,
yeah.
Bugs was also in the battle. Me and Bugs had to battle each other. And Proof was like coaching both of us to battle each other. It was hilarious. And Bugs, rest in peace, was murdered like a month after that in Detroit. But yeah, so Proof was just a very supportive dude. He was always out in the scene. He was like just very humble and hilarious, and to me, he did battling in his best possible way. Like, he was the type of person where he would battle somebody and clown them, but, you know what I'm saying, come up after them and support them in every way humanly possible in real life, you know? So it wasn't like it wasn't a thing where you could take it personal with him because you knew right away that it was all for fun. It was all for the competition and the love of the lyrics, the art of lyricism. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So Proof was amazing like that. And I'm still like in disbelief that he's gone. You know, because he was just such a staple. He would be out all the time, and that's part of how he got killed, because he was just so easily accessible. You know, to people in the city, whether they loved him or hated him. And it's a lot of great work happening in his honor. His mother, you know, is doing work in his, you know, to continue his legacy, etc. And then with Dilla, like, I only met him briefly a few times. The first show I ever did with Anomalies actually was in 97, and it was in Philadelphia. It was an event the Bahamadia threw at this community center out there, and Sun Village performed that night, and I remember, like, you know, they killed it. We got to say what up and just make that Detroit, you know, connection there. But you know, Dilla was pretty much like to himself. He was like, you know, pretty laid back.
Yeah.
So I didn't really get to kick it with him too much. I had the honor to work on a couple of projects that he was on, you know, particularly through one of his, you know, old friends, Wajid, who's like the main producer I work with.
Yeah.
And with the Platinum Pipe Pipers project, you know, we did the song Shotgun together.
Shotgun. On your marks and set go, spitting these bars of death to my heart's content. So wild, you playing Russian roulette and gunning with one in the chamber. This ain't what you expect, you coming up under the radar. The blood and sweat shed for the love and respect, but my landlord hungers for papers. Y'all need to start cutting some checks.
But we were never in the same space when we did that. But you know, as far as just how his work like influenced and shaped me, like it was just to everybody from the city, it was like a total torchbearer of what was possible, like being from the city and then going out and working with these artists that we grew up admiring, like you know, A Tribe Called Quest and different artists from, you know, the East and West Coast. And he was able to really like bring a unique Detroit sound and like, you know, just radiate throughout the whole world by collaborating with those artists, and through that was able to come back, reach back to his own community and bring out, you know, different artists from the city, whether it be, you know, Fat Cat or whether it be Sun Village or all the different other artists that he put out once he had that platform. And I just think, to me, that's a huge model, and it's a very different model from what other artists who have been successful from the city have been able to do. Like, you know, like he really like was humble enough where he didn't become a cult of personality really till after he passed.
Right.
Like, and before he passed, he was just so humble that it was like, you know what I'm saying, he was able to shine and like really share that shine with everyone around him.
Again, and keep going on the record. You know, you say you have no labels or vampires, no funders or grant writers.
Keep on, even when my hand tires. No labels of vampires, no funders of grant writers. Inspired by freedom fighters before us and coming after us. For the present survivors of human massacres.
But now you're a fellow at two different foundations. So
three.
Okay. Why did you decide to go to the nonprofit foundation route? What did it offer that a more traditional music business model could?
Well, the fellowships and grants that I have are actually not nonprofits technically.
Okay.
They're like artist grants. How did that even start? I was doing an event in Chicago. It was like a women in hip-hop event. My homegirl, Ange 13, Real Dope MC out of the Shy, invited me to come out there and be a part of this panel about women in hip-hop. It was at Columbia College. And after the panel, I connected with this woman who works out there named Jane Sachs. And she runs the Institute for Women and Gender and the Arts and Media.
Yeah.
And she was like, hey, like, we do this fellowship program. Do you have any ideas for a project that you would want our support with?
Right.
And I was like, I was just, you know, at a loss, because I never even thought that was possible for a hip hop artist to get a fellowship, like in Canada maybe, in Europe maybe,
right.
You know what I'm saying? But
right.
I never really heard of that as a possibility in the US. So so I was at a loss, and it kind of took me like a year or two to come back to her with a proposal that fit. And, you know, it was like no strings attached. She came to me and offered it, and then through that, I was able to start doing the research on my project Complex Movements, which is the project I've been working on for the last 4 years about complex science and social movements.
Yeah, that, I wanted to talk to you about that.
Yeah, I would love to speak more about. And to me, that was just like a huge opportunity I wouldn't have had otherwise, to be able to just focus all the way in and do that research. So then, let's see. So after that, it kind of opened up like what was possible for me. Like, and so different opportunities started coming my way, and instead of just, you know, passing them on to artists who I thought it would fit, like there were more traditional artists and, you know, visual arts or, you know, that did more classical type music, whatever, like I was starting to consider them. And so when there was this grant that or fellowship that started in Detroit called the Kresge Arts in Detroit Fellowship, and, you know, I applied to it and I got it, and it was like a total honor to be part of that, along with, you know, several other Detroit performers that included Monica Blair and Haleem Strings, who's like a really dope B-boy and jitter out of the D. And it was just like, you know, a groundbreaking project for Detroit artists to have, like, an opportunity to do that. And I felt like by me doing that, again, it was like no strings attached. They didn't require of you to, like, really report on it in any particular way. And I just got to explore my ideas in a way that wasn't limited to what's commercially viable. And so after that, I went ahead and I applied to this thing called the MAP Fund, and just got that recently, and that's gonna start in the fall. But yeah, like, I highly encourage, like, artists, especially artists who have a lot of really, like, far out concepts that you think that, like, oh, that would never sell, or I would never have the budget to do that. You know, I'll never be able to pull that off. Like, certain grants, like, the more, you know, multidisciplinary, the more mediums you put into one pot, like, the more perspectives you bring to it, the concept, you know, could be real grandiose, but, like, you have this whole other realm that you can present it in, which is, like, the world of you know, artists and creative thinkers, creative performers that are doing more experimental things than what the music industry will allow you to do, or what, you know what I'm saying, even hip-hop fans are sometimes ready to, like, you know, just support outright, like, you know, sometimes artists want you to just do the same thing every time. I mean, fans want you to just, as an artist, do the same thing every time and just, you know, rapidy rap. Like, sometimes I don't want to just rapidy rap. Like, sometimes I want to, you know, make a music box and sit there and you know, create, like, one song that's going to perfectly fit a music box. So, you know, with this kind of, like, support, I can pursue that. So, in that song, the grants I was talking about was more so in most of the community organizing work I do. Mm-hmm. I don't do it through grants. I prefer grassroots fundraising to grants. Amazing. New York, man.
Yeah.
All right, so what was I saying?
About grants.
When you do community organizing, a lot of organizations end up, you know, spending the majority of their time either applying for grants, administrating grants. There was one time where the organization I worked with, Detroit Summer, we had received this one grant that took so much administration that it almost bankrupted us. You know what I'm saying? Because they like audit you down to the penny, and then, you know what I'm saying? It's a nightmare, a bureaucratic nightmare to try to get this money that is supposedly for you to do this great work in the community with.
Yeah.
So ultimately, like, by being able to do things through grassroots fundraising means and through, you know, other, like, creative resourcing means, you don't have those strings attached. And even still, like, you know, like, with my first album, the way that I resourced being able to press it up was by selling pre-sales, like, a year in advance with these little, like, hand silk screen vouchers that me and Emergence made. You know, Wesley Taylor designed and printed them.
Yeah.
And, like, and that's how we were able to fundraise to
everyone's press doing it up. That now. You're ahead of the curve.
No doubt. You know what I'm saying? I was doing Kickstarter before there was Kickstarter, you know? So that's where that line came from.
Okay. Awesome. I wanted to jump into something else, which is Deuce Ipsy, that song in particular.
Deuce Ipsy, yeah.
White picket fences, green lawns, nice, rich, expensive, college campus, so progressive, every child advances, lies and deception, difference is tolerated with a few exceptions, so liberal and colorblind, hear a beat when you cross the street, let the bubble pop, and culture shock and the cost of the seat, off the beat, and pass.
I'd love for you to talk a bit about your impressions of Ann Arbor that led you to write Deuce Ipsy. It reminded me of, I don't know if you know the Phil Oaks tune, Love Me, I'm a Liberal.
I cried when they shot Medgar Evers. Tears ran down my spine. And I cried when they shot Mr. Kennedy, as though I'd lost a father of mine. But Malcolm X got what was coming. He got what he asked for this time. So love me, love me, love me. I'm a liberal. Get it?
No, I would love to check that out.
It's kind of the same vibe about nice. Super, you know, self-righteous liberals who are progressive about issues that don't affect them. And super conservative on ones that do. So maybe you can talk a little about your impressions of Ann Arbor that led you to write that tune.
Man, growing up in Ann Arbor, like, you know, you saw a lot of people who were, like, older, like, you know, and thought of themselves as hippies and, like, you know, maybe still smoke weed or whatever. But, like, ultimately, like, their politics were not that progressive and not even progressive. Like, they just didn't really have, like, a lot of respect for other people in their community and particular, you know, people of color that were in our city, poor people that were in our city were completely, you know, trampled upon in more ways than one. And one of the main things for me was growing up, you know, when I moved to Ann Arbor, I was 7 years old. And I went to an elementary school called Bryant Elementary. Bryant Elementary was in Stony Brook. Stony Brook is like one of the main low-income areas in Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
And you know, mostly like Black and Arab and Asian, Latino. And like a lot of the kids that I grew up with, you know what I'm saying, like went to different paths than I was able to go. Than a lot of other people that had like more class privilege or that were white, you know, that we grew up with were able to go.
Bryant Elementary, childhood friends from Stony Brook, now in the penitentiary. It ain't coincidentally checking for middle schoolers, criminals, by teachers who belittled you, claiming they liberal. By 14,
and you know, you saw certain people that you were being raised with getting tracked into, you know, the prison system, being tracked into, you know, just like the special classes and all those things like that. And then suddenly, like, we were completely divided from each other. Like, all these kids that I knew from Stony Brook, like, you know what I'm saying? We were just living these whole different lives. And it was just, like, a big loss of this community that we had built. And it was definitely caused by, you know, the fake liberal, like, you know, just complete, in my eyes, like, white supremacist way that Ann Arbor runs as a city. The city dump is across the street from the projects, you know. And then when I was in high school, the Ku Klux Klan spoke on the roof of City Hall.
Off the beat and past, reaching in my past. How'd I get involved? Trying to keep the Klan from speaking on the roof of City Hall. But analyze oppression on the daily. The truth of the dual city that raised me and failed me. Even worse than
I was gonna say, that was the thing that started your sort of activism, right?
I mean, it was ridiculous. They literally, like, spoke on the roof of City Hall. Like, I went to high school up the street from City Hall, and it's like you walk down the street from your high school, and it's like the Grand Dragon sitting on the roof. And then, you know, it was just absurd, and I was disgusted, and I was angry, but it didn't feel like I could really do anything about it except for just, you know, do what everyone else was doing, which is throw bottles and, you know, be violent against them, you know, which I knew a lot of people that did that.
Sure.
But ultimately, like, they all got arrested, and the people who started the rally, which were a bunch of, like, sectarian, you know what I'm saying, whatever, I'm not even going to speak on who they are, but sectarian people who, you know, like to rile people up.
Yeah.
And then go to court and defend them and get the, you know, little kickback from that.
Yeah.
It was just a mess, and it really showed me how, like, Ann Arbor was down more so for so-called free speech than they were down for actually any type of justice or any type of real equity, you know what I mean? So that's kind of like what sparked it.
Okay.
And actually what's happening currently right now is the schools that I mentioned in the song, like Roberto Clemente, which is like a school where a lot of students were pushed out of, like, the mainstream schools and pushed to Roberto Clemente. At one point, I was kicked out of my high school and like pushed to Stone School, but then I almost went to Clemente. But Clemente is actually about to potentially be closed down, and like there's a couple schools in Ypsilanti that are being like combined with each other. So right. It's like the same kind of cuts that Detroit is facing, like Ann Arbor is facing, but they're taking them out on like, again, like the schools where the low income, like communities of color are being pushed into. And it's just like the same cycle repeating itself. And Ann Arbor just being able to be in this like bubble of privilege and you know, continue to think of itself as if it's actually still, you know, in the 60s.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So on the Shapeshifters record, yeah. Right, you have this, this kind of motif of hammers that runs through it.
Yeah. I'll be the Gabriel with a sledgehammer. Let's stand it's red hand. Turn the volume up. Smash these cats like Gallagher. Soon as I wrap the album up. Thought I'd never finish it. For more than a minute, I wish to end the shit. Put down my penmanship and get a carpentry apprenticeship. Swinging sledgehammers for a minimum wage. Renovate the DV shelter for women with AIDS. Believe it's not a mirror to reflect reality. It's a hammer. With which we shape it. Yeah. Can you
talk a little bit about that image and why it was so important? I know for you it had a literal meaning as well as a figurative one.
This guy pays attention. Y'all need to pay attention. Sledgehammer. Let's see. First of all, I was working a carpentry apprenticeship at the time that I was starting to write the record. So I was literally swinging a sledgehammer every day, knocking down walls at this building we were rehabilitating. It was like a domestic violence shelter for women with AIDS on the west side of Detroit. And so like that was a big part of it. And I just wanted to ground it in something like real literal, but also like in how I felt about a lot of the ideas that I wanted to convey. Like, you know, I can be very nuanced and subtle, and I definitely don't want to be didactic, you know, but at the same time, like, I want to get my message across. There's no point that you're gonna miss my message. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, and so, for me, it was just about like, you know, taking that quote from Seven, 14KT. He put that on Sledgehammer when he gave me the beat initially. Mm-hmm. The him and DJ Haircut, aka Mayor Hawthorne, had made. And you know, that quote kind of sparked a lot of what I was feeling for the whole record.
Wanting people to listen, you can't just tap them on the shoulder anymore. You have to hit them with a sledgehammer. And then you'll notice you've got their strict attention.
Sledgehammer was the first song I wrote on the record, and it kind of guided like the whole process. But then, you know, again, with Shapeshifters being able to refer to the Brecht quote and say, you know, that through art we're able to shape our reality, you know, that it's a hammer and it's not just a mirror, like, That's a big value that guides my work and why I don't just talk about how terrible things are all the time, but also try to like project my vision for what's possible.
Right. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So one final thing. So when I was looking on your website back in the early days of Rap Genius, yeah. I was very surprised to discover that you had a system that was pretty much exactly the same as ours.
Yes. Emergence so, Travel Agency.
Yeah, eerily similar to what we put up at around the same time. I'd love to hear just your thoughts on Rap Genius, what you think of us. You've definitely been one of the more responsive and helpful artists to us, even correcting me sometimes when I get certain Detroit details wrong, names of sodas and stuff.
Oh, man. Rap Genius is awesome. Like, when I first put up People Not Places, which is a song I have about Palestine, and the denial of right of return for Palestinians. The remains. My evil misses people, not places. As you see the town from names of Arabic, the Hebrew places. The policies of evil and racist, deceitful and heinous. You'll never be a people stable, legal displacement. Which yesterday actually marked the 64th year of Israeli colonization of Palestine and 64 years of Palestinian resistance to that. And so when I made the song People Not Places, I realized that a lot of the references within it were gonna go over people's heads, because it was something that, you know, unless you really pay attention to the issue of what's happening in Palestine and the different injustices that Israel is doing and how the U.S. is supporting those, like a lot of those names and references were not going to have any relevancy to you. So I wanted to make it as relevant as possible to people. So so we created this travel agency, Emergence Travel Agency. It's like an online media installation. And with People Not Places, we laid out all the lyrics. And then literally like a month or two later, I looked up and Rap Genius had did the same thing with the same song. And it was amazing to me. Like, I thought y'all had bit it first. I was like, damn, they bit my shit, man. What the hell? But then I realized that we were just, you know, just total synchronicity, completely aligned on some psychic shit. So I appreciate you for that. I think that, you know, it's so many times where I've had people ask me about certain lyrics and I don't feel like explaining it, and I could just refer them to Rap Genius. And it's like also additionally, like my homeboy in Palestine who is in the group Dem, his name is Tamron Afar, like he'll hook me up sometimes because we go back and forth, talk about lyrics all the time, and he'll hook me up and be like, what does this reference mean? You know, because it won't really make sense to him in Palestine. And I'll be able to like refer him to the site and he'll like look stuff up on there, you know? So it's like, it's artists like myself who, you know, are learning English through hip hop. It's not just about learning the language. It's like also about, you know, understanding the references and the stories that go with stuff. And, you know, I just think that what y'all do by decoding the lyrics is really, you know, it's really helping the artists to get our full multi-layered messages across, because so often, you know, in this day and age where people could just like get a new song a day, you know, or 20 new songs a day through blog, you know, downloading or whatever, it's like really, really awesome to be able to actually have a place where someone's taking the time to get the full potential out of a piece and not just skim it, you know. So I appreciate y'all for that. And yeah, it was a lot of work to do it for the one song I did it, so I appreciate y'all doing it for the rest. Even though I am going to go in there with my account and start battling Gene for
Rap Genius Supremacy.
For best art, Rap Genius Supremacy
here. We look forward to it.
Thanks for having me. Peace.
This has been an updated version of a previously released episode of The Cypher. Visit thecyphershow.com for information about this episode or any one of our others. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at The Cypher Show. Hit us up. Let us know what you thought of this episode, ideas for future guests, anything you'd want to talk about. Also, one more time, find The Cypher on iTunes. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
You know, it was like no strings attached. She came to me and offered it.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
We're not that progressive and not even progressive. Like, they just didn't really have like a lot of respect for other people in their community.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
Every time I saw him, he would just like come up to me and quote a lyric I said at an open mic.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
The two things I want you to say.
Okay.
Please.